Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's November the 6th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Well, actually, no, it's not November the 6th. I'm speaking to you now on Monday, November the 3rd. And as you may be able to tell by the sound of my voice, I have spent the past several days battling one howler of a cold, combined with my annual bout of URI, upper respiratory infection, bronchitis, whatever this crud is that I come down with roughly every 18 months, no matter what the season is. Now, the result is that I will not be doing much direct speaking on the podcast this week. Fortunately, I have some clips from a Mike Harris show that I did a few weeks ago, and also part two of my appearance on Joe Adams' White Voice show to play for you, which will take care of most of my vocals this time around. I may or may not drop in a brief comment on any Election Day surprises at the end of the show, but right now let me bring on Mike before I go into a coughing spasm that makes me sound like I've got Ebola.
Mike, are you muted?
Yeah, I was muted. I did it. Oh, gosh. If I don't do this twice a week, I'm not having a good week. Anyway, let's start over. Good morning and welcome. This is Mike Harris on Revolution Radio. Today is Thursday, October 22nd, 2014. And as promised, my guest today is author and social engineer, Harold Covington.
Hey, Harold, how are you, sir?
Pretty good. So usually social engineering we think of in bad concepts, but I look at what you put together, you know, fictitiously in your novels and think, you know, I could live in a place like that. It would suit me.
That's part of the reason I wrote them.
First, I got to ask you a number of questions here. You know, what do you think is going on in our country today? I mean, this economy here is, we've never had a recovery from 2007. It's a bunch of BS. You know, the government's changed the metrics and they're cooking the books in order to make it look like we have low unemployment when it's really probably 30-35% right now. And, you know, nothing is prospering.
92 million people
drying up.
There's, what, 92 million people unemployed, so you do the math.
Well, yeah, you have 92 million people who are of working age who are seeking jobs and can't find them. And anybody who's over 55, if you're not working, they've rated you as being retired. You know, they don't have to count you.
Well, effectively, you are. If you're over 50 and you lose it, if you're over 40 and you're a white male and you lose your job, there's a very good chance you'll never work again. And if you're over 50, that's it. I mean, once you lose your job after the age of 50, you're done.
Well, sad but true. But, you know, what do you think is going to happen here? I've been sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop on this 2007-2008 recession. And it hasn't happened yet. But I've been expecting things to go from the frying pan into the fire, so to speak.
I never cease to marvel at this society's seemingly inexhaustible ability to maintain an even keel. I won't say right itself, but it's like you're, you know, looking at the Titanic slowly, slowly sinking. But instead of upending and going down bow first, glug, 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 it's like the ship is slowly, slowly sinking beneath the waves, but the keel is even. And on the upper decks, they're still dancing around and partying and that sort of stuff. But I genuinely believe that's coming to an end now. Now, for many years, I was one of these people who quietly, or sometimes not so quietly, doubted that I would ever see what we refer to in the right wing as the balloon going up. Now, the past couple of years have convinced me that it might finally be here. And by that, I mean that it might go up in my lifetime, put it that way. I won't go off into a long rant and rave about my reasons for thinking so, but what we're headed for right now, if there is no cataclysmic event, is in another 20 years or so, Brazil at best, where a small white technocratic minority and a small white elite of wealth and power runs a country of coffee-colored, gooey masses. If you've ever seen the movie Soylent Green, that's pretty much what we're headed for now, but I don't think it's going to get that far. I genuinely now am convinced that within the lifetime of, well, you're in my generation, there is going to be some kind of major cataclysmic event, and it remains to be seen exactly what that is, because there are several possibilities. I believe last time I was on here, we discussed the possibility of a mass collapse of the EBT and welfare system leading to minority rioting in cities and then moving out in the suburbs, blah, blah, blah. But it could be almost anything right now that will set it over. Like, it's possible, for example, that this situation in Ferguson, Missouri could get out of hand to the point where there's some kind of riot down there. The cops have to shoot a couple of our African-American fellow citizens. And that could be basically what sets the black masses off into massive rioting. I mean, it could be darn near anything. We're at that point right now where the slightest spark anywhere could set the building on fire.
Well, that's kind of what I'm anticipating here. I was going to ask you, you've already jumped ahead to Ferguson, but I'll save that for a minute. But what kind of symptoms are we going to see before the balloon goes up? Do you have any clues? Do you have any?
Well, the symptoms that we're seeing now. 92 million adults in this country are without jobs of all races, but especially the people who used to be the most productive elements of our society, the white males, the middle-aged white male who used to basically keep the whole show going for the 50 years in the time of abundance, is now the hardest hit by unemployment. I mean, when we were coming along as younger men, did we ever seriously think that we would, number one, see 92 million unemployed in this country, number two, that this country could survive it? But here we are. Definitely one symptom is massive unemployment. The constant involvement in foreign wars, if that is not a sign of a decaying empire, like we're having a situation where our military expenditure is outstripping our entire gross national product, and that type of economic situation, that big black hole that a nation or an empire's wealth is sucked into, cannot continue indefinitely. So that's another symptom. We are seeing the symptoms right now. Complete polarization politically, complete racial disharmony. We are confronting now the living proof that diversity does not bring strength. It brings division and chaos and unrest. You just go on and on, but see, we're seeing the symptoms right now. It's just that the patient isn't dying. He's just sort of lying there in his bed, you know.
And in a coma, yeah, just about.
Yeah, in a coma and defecating and urinating all over himself, but he's still not dead. I think one tipping point that may come as early as the beginning of the year, I'm probably jumping ahead again, but I'm sure you've heard about the 34 million alien identification cards, i.e. green cards, that the Obama administration has quietly put out tenders to private manufacturers and whatnot. It's clear that after the elections, we're going to have executive amnesty, and so that could tip it.
Something needs to tip us. We need to have some movement in a positive direction. Somehow, some way. You know, the question is, you know, how do we foment that and how do we propagate that throughout the rest of our society here?
Well, I yesterday completed a Radio Free Northwest in which I once again exhorted my listeners to bring people to northwestfront.org. I usually save these pro-NF tirades for the end of our shows, I know, but the simple fact is that the Northwest Front, the Northwest Imperative, we have what the white man needs in this country. And the way to produce positive forward movement is to get about 50 million white people to go to northwestfront.org and read the contents, get hold of my Northwest novels, and understand that there is an alternative to this crawling chaos. This came up in my show yesterday because I actually quoted a column by a guy that I call my court Jew, James Howard Kunstler. And he's the only Jew that I will allow on my blog or on my podcast or in my magazine, because basically he says what has to be said, and he says it so well that I had no hesitation about recommending him for our own people, which is unusual for a Jew. Anyway, he was saying that we have a society that undervalues and invalidates young men. Now, he didn't say white men, being a Jew, of course, he's not officially racial, but the coded racial subtext is still there. And so, in essence, we have what the white man needs, and we need to control the process of our degeneration, because all those young men, those young white men who are unemployed, who have no future, eventually they're going to not just hang around on street corners, not just hang around on the internet. They're going to do something. I'm not the only one who sees it.
Okay. All right, let's switch gears a little bit because I do want to cover this Ferguson thing. Now, why don't you give us your objective appraisal as to what's really going on in Ferguson? I know you're not there, but you studied these issues for a very, very long time. What's going on? What is triggering the Negroes in Ferguson to respond the way they're responding? What's the mindset?
More so than elsewhere, because let's face it, cops shoot young black men darn near every day in this country.
They shoot other black men every day in this country. They kill each other more than anybody else does.
All right, so why here in Ferguson? Frankly, I think it is orchestrated by certain elements in the left-wing blogosphere. I follow these blogs, as I may have mentioned in the past, and I think it's being orchestrated on the QT by the Democrat Party as part of their midterm elections campaign. They are desperate to galvanize the black vote. Matter of fact, there was an article about that yesterday. They are desperate to turn out and beef up the black vote in these midterm elections because right now it doesn't look like they're going to do too well. Now, I'm not quite so optimistic. I personally believe that the Republicans will do well, but number one, the Republicans aren't the solution, and number two, whether we like it or not, the Republicans are now regarded as the white party, and the simple fact is that normal white people in this country are now outnumbered, and I don't really think it matters how much of a turnout the Republican Party gets. The fact is that the Democrats have already succeeded in creating, to a large extent, this artificial majority, which will eventually, they hope, create a one-party state in this country. Like I say, I think the Republicans will do well, but not as well as they think, because we're just outnumbered. There's too many blacks, too many illegal aliens who will be voting in the absence of voter ID laws. There is too many, frankly, poor whites who are now government dependent and who will respond to this Democrat scream, oh, don't vote Republican, they're going to take away your EBT cards and your food stamps and blah, blah, blah. And so they have to galvanize the black vote. Basically, they have to work up the blacks, get them all agitated, get them yelling and screaming about the white man done me wrong and blah, blah, blah. And it's just the same thing we saw with the Occupy movement before the 2012 election. These so-called movements are, in essence, cat's paws for the Democrats and the present power structure. And so I think that's largely what's happening in Ferguson. I think, depending on what happens during the midterm elections, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see Ferguson, Missouri just go away after the election. Or they may decide to use it for some other agitational purpose. But I think basically that's what it is. The Ferguson, Missouri thing right now is part of the Democrat election strategy, just like Occupy Wall Street was in 2012.
But the other thing is, well, you look at cat's paws, you know, Occupy for the Democrats, and you look at the Tea Party for the Republicans. It's kind of the same issue there, where they got the Republicans fired up on that side.
Pretty much.
Parties are playing these disingenuous games. And the thing that I come back to every time is that there's not a hair's worth of difference between the two of them. They're both funded by the same major contributors that own both parties. So it doesn't matter what you say. It matters how you vote once you're there. And these guys, they do what they're paid to do. And they're paid by the lobbyists. They're paid by big business. They no longer represent the American people. And so my premise, this election, and this is probably maybe one of the last peaceful things we can do, is to go ahead and vote out all incumbents. And we could fire 435 congressmen, we can fire 33 senators, we can get rid of 468 out of the 535 incompetent paid-off shills that create our law, run our government for us. And I think it's time to fire them all. And you know, it's not going to hurt. It may not have the outcome I want, but it certainly isn't going to hurt us any.
Well, the problem basically in this country, Mike, is systemic because, in essence, ballot access is restricted to those who have the official Heckscher or kosher seal of approval. I mean, voting out incumbents is, you know, all very well and good, and I'm sure it would help some, but the fact is that the person you vote in would almost certainly, if they weren't corrupt before,
they'd be easily corrupted.
They'd be corrupted after 6 months in Washington. Well, I mean, Congress is like prison. I mean, it's kind of notorious that a lot of normal guys, if they make a mistake, they go into prison. They're not criminals when they go in, but they darn sure are criminals when they come out because it's just the way of life in which they've been forced to live. And I think if some young idealistic person is elected to Congress, if they're young and idealistic and want to do the best for the country and do the best for what's right when they go in, I think that'll last a few months and then they'll be as corrupt as anybody. Power corrupts, and in our kind of system whereby the whole power system turns on controlling the money in the largest source of wealth in the world, i.e. the American taxpayer, see, that's what Washington is all about. Who controls the money? Who spends it for what? this is one reason why the Republicans have more or less given up, or at least their establishment has, any idea of ever regaining the White House or ever changing the country. They're just more concerned about getting their cut of the pie, because that, in essence, is what our political system has become. It's become about who's got the money, who gets how much federal budget, who gets to spend on what. It's no longer a political system. It's basically an extension of the economy.
Well, government, boy, that seems to be where we're at already. That's what we're stuck with here, because we're becoming more and more of a entitlement class out here. And you know, we've got, you know, you said before, the EBT situation. The war on poverty created a permanent underclass out there. And there's people now for a second and a third and a fourth generation who haven't worked, don't work, and aren't going to work. You know? And
Have you heard of UBI? Now, this is one of the reasons I read these left-wing websites, because you get to actually look at the agenda. UBI is universal basic income, and it's one of the ideas that the extreme lefties and liberals and progressive types are floating on their private blogs. Kind of like gay liberation 20 years ago. Gay liberation and gay marriage was just kind of a gleam in their eye. But I'm sure we'll be hearing this more and more as they establish their one-party state. The idea basically that being that at age 16, everybody gets a government check, and you're therefore free and liberated to do whatever you want in life. And of course, with our culture, what most people will want to do is lie around and draw their checks and live in Section 8 housing and play video games, etc. But that's coming. And of course, anybody that threatens the concept of your UBI, your monthly government check, can never be voted into power because they're mean and evil and blah, blah, blah. So this is basically what's coming. They literally want to create a universal welfare state where everybody is dependent on big government in the purest financial sense. But I don't think they can do it. I just don't think they have the competence to create something like that. And they're going to make a mistake. They're going to blow it, put it that way. There's no saying that any fool can turn an aquarium into fish soup, but nobody can turn the fish soup back into an aquarium. And that's what we're seeing right now. They're in the process of turning the American aquarium into fish soup that they can ladle out via the EBT system and the welfare system and food stamps and all that sort of stuff in order to buy votes. And when that fish soup runs out, the aquarium is gone and it can't be reconstructed.
The other problem we have is we've got on the other side of the scale, besides a permanent underclass that's never going to work and never has, is we've got more concentration of wealth and fewer hands. So, you know, you look at these two diametrically opposed trends that are going on in our society, and how do we get back to the middle ground? I mean, the middle class was what America prided itself on. It's what gave us our strength, what gave us our economic vitality, what gave us our technological prowess. You had a lot of people who were seemingly well-educated, who were the most productive workers in the world, and boy, they broke it. They took it apart, and they broke it, and it seems intentional to me.
Well, it probably was, and I'll be honest, Mike, it can't be fixed in the sense that there is never going to be any return to the good old days of the 1950s or 60s when everybody had a Brady Bunch-style house in the suburbs and two cars in the garage and 2.5 kids, and they all went to Six Flags on the weekend and had backyard barbecues and this sort of stuff. That way of life is gone forever. It is not returning, and we need to start looking to the future to see what we can salvage out of the mess that the liberals, progressives, Jews, Democrats, etc., whatever you want to call the enemy. Basically, we have to try and figure out some way to salvage some kind of future out of this mess that these sons of bitches have made, pardon my language, because we can't turn back the clock. This idea of, you know, that we're going to recover something of what we once had, well, maybe. But I'm getting more and more dubious. Maybe it's just because I'm getting old and crotchety, but I really am getting more and more doubtful that any kind of recovery in the normal sense of the term is possible now, because we're just too far gone. We have lost the culture. We have lost two whole generations of white people, white youngsters. Getting back to this Kunstler article, he was talking about the way this society now devalues and invalidates young men, meaning young white men. There is now nothing for young white men to do in this society except go into the army. The system still wants us as cannon fodder, but that's about it. And so what's going to happen, and this is Kunstler talking now, not me, eventually there are going to be large convoys of pickup trucks and other vehicles rolling across North America full of armed men who are lopping off heads in the manner of ISIS or some kind of American equivalent of that, because when it blows, it's going to blow.
Okay, well, hang on, Harold. We've got a break coming up here. Folks, stick with us. We'll be right back after this short break, or with Harold Covington. Stick with us.
In ancient times, the MacGregors were one of the most violent and disruptive clans in Scotland. They had a special knack for pissing off King James VI with stunts like killing his royal officers and putting their heads on the altars of churches and swearing blood vengeance oaths on the heads, that kind of thing. Sort of a 16th century ISIS. In 1603, King James banned the use of the name MacGregor completely throughout his realm, and by decree he changed the name of all the existing MacGregors to Campbell, thus legally erasing the whole clan from existence, and also thus transferring all their land and property to his allies, the Campbell clan. He then gave orders to the Duke of Argyll, who was the chief of the Campbells, to go out and exterminate all the MacGregors and make sure that their land and property stayed his. Now, this didn't work out very well, but the ban stayed in legal force for 171 years, during which time it was against the law in Scotland to use the name MacGregor. Some of you may have seen the movie Rob Roy with Liam Neeson, which gets into the subject a bit. Anyway, this is Andy Stewart.
The moon's on the lake, and the mist's on the brain. The clan has a name that is nameless by day. Their signal to fight, wage from monarchs they drew, is heard but by night in their vengeful halloo. Then halloo, 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 Dragula. Though they rob us of name and pursue us with beagles, give their roofs to the flame and their flesh to the eagles. And gather, 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 Gregola. Gather, 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 Gregola. While there's leaves in the forest and there's foam on the river, MacGregor, despite them, shall flourish forever. Glenorchy's proud mountains, Kilchurn and her towers, Glenstrae and Glenlyon no longer are ours. We're landless, 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 Gregola. Landless, 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 Gregola. Through the depths of Loch Katrine, the steed shall career, o'er the peak of Ben Lomond, the galley shall steer. And the rocks of Craig rise, stand like icicles melt, and our wrongs be forgot, or our vengeance unfell. Then halloo, 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 Gregola. If they rob us of name and pursue us with beagles, give their roofs to the flame and their flesh to the eagles. Then gather, 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 Gregola. Gather, 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 Gregola. While there's leaves in the forest and there's foam on the river, MacGregor, despite them, shall flourish forever. And gather, 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 Gregola. Gather, 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 Gregola.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. I'm Andy Donner, and today I want to cover the issue of unwillingness to relocate. This particular rant, as opposed to some others I've done, was inspired by a comment left on one episode of Radio Free Northwest some months ago. I really wanted to stop and cover this when it was fresh, but at the time I was in the middle of my real politics talks and didn't want to stop since I had a particular plan in mind. Anyhow, a regular commenter expressed his opinion that in today's world, most white people have too many ties and things to worry about in order to up and relocate. Is that really the case? Let's explore this idea a bit. Quite regularly, the party is approached by someone claiming a level of interest in the Northwest Imperative, who immediately follows that interest up with some sort of reason why they either can't move right now or do not intend to move at all. While I get this on some level, it should be obvious we don't expect someone to literally drop everything and show up in the Pacific Northwest. Even the most simple relocation of a single person takes more planning and preparation than is possible in that scenario. It always strikes us as a little bit odd that a new contact would feel the need to make excuses that they're not already resident in the proposed homeland. The long-term refusals, however, are of much more concern. To some people's credit, they're direct enough to admit they simply don't want to come home, and they leave it at that. There's another sort, though, that is dead set against their own homecoming, but nevertheless insists that the party is doing things badly or wrong or whatever, and can't help but to try to involve themselves because they're upset at the lack of progress. The contradiction therein is obvious, but that's neither here nor there today. These refusals are almost always for reasons relating to these so-called ties or bonds or attachments or whatever it is that's keeping someone where they are. I get that. In fact, while coming up with the material for this submission, I remarked to a local party comrade that I had to give up a job where I'd been promoted into a business-critical position, a place to live I really liked, and the relatively close proximity to the rest of my immediate family. Those, along with a few other things I chose to leave behind, are usually the concerns given when migration is refused or neglected. But generally speaking, all of this applies to everyone who has ever made a move of any sort, especially those who obeyed the Northwest Imperative like they knew they should. Further, humanity hasn't exactly changed a whole lot over the years, and these exact preferences were just as common in the past, both recently and in antiquity. You will note people of all sorts regularly make moves all over the world for all sorts of reasons. The comrade I was speaking with reminded me that long-distance moves are usually made for economic reasons, and while I concede that's true, it's not a hard and fast rule. Further, we've got a functional economy in the Pacific Northwest, you know, but economics are far from the only reasons people relocate themselves. Quite a bit of the time, moves are made purely on personal preference. Another comrade pointed out that quite a few of us move simply for white flight. Remember my previous talk, though. You can't escape. If you're going to move, come home to where you're supposed to be. It's true that the liberation and creation of the Northwest American Republic is a monumental task, but as it stands right now, the party is only asking you to move. People move all the time. Therefore, we're not asking you to do anything people don't already do for a wide variety of reasons. We who have come home are regularly told by those who refuse to do so that what we're doing is worth it or very important or that we're called to do even more, but somehow they're not. So we're expected to make up for their deliberate absence because they're somehow better than us to the extent that their lives are more important than ours were before migrating? That may not be the message they intended to convey, but it's the only real outgrowth of the things they say to us. One recent migrant I spoke to just today mentioned that he turned on a local radio talk show run by some kike who was lamenting the increase in Seattle's white population as a percentage. But this is in spite of various companies constantly moving WOGs into the city. So clearly, white people do not in any way have baggage today which didn't exist in the past such that they are prevented from upping stakes. Further, this recent migrant is only a recent migrant because he had a legally binding agreement which kept him from coming home sooner. That and the likelihood of someone dying if they are physically moved are the only real reasons to delay homecoming longer than is otherwise appropriate. I know family situations can be a mess sometimes, but one comrade who has contacted me over Facebook made known his intent to migrate, despite not being able to take his children with him. The reality of child custody in America today is appalling, and I genuinely give pause before suggesting someone move away from their children. But if you're unable to see them because of the father-hating court system, there's little to be done about it. I quite literally go cold when I consider that prospect, but once again, objective logic of the sort required to prevent white genocide isn't exactly warm and fuzzy. Lastly, I need to remind everyone of a talk I gave quite some time ago on RFN regarding solving problems. I won't rehash all that right now, but it's pertinent to the matter at hand, so I'll recap. Just about every single thing keeping a person from making their migration is something they have to take care of one way or another, but have been putting off. Before any of you start shouting at your computer, iPod, or whatever, I admit up front this is something I was guilty of as well. There were things I had to fix about my own life in order to make migration possible. Whether it's an issue with one's employability, a family situation, underwater real estate, or anything else, excepting very extreme cases, it's not really an excuse to skip out on Northwest migration. I remember an angry email a young person out east sent Harold some time ago, wherein he expressed his frustration with the party that he shouldn't be expected to migrate because he can't find a job. I especially like bringing up this example, because even if the Butler Plan had never existed, this guy would still have to find a way to support himself. Getting cross with the party for insisting you come home and help us will gain you nothing. Hail victory, comrades.
And this is the second part of my appearance on the Joe Adams Show, The White Voice, on Sunday, October 26th.
Well, they figured out, basically, that they haven't really pulled it off because their affirmative action hire that they put in the White House has basically screwed the pooch. He has created mass misery across the country. And yes, I know all the fine lines of distinction as to whether or not Obama is actually running the country or the degree to which he is or is not running the country. That's very definitely open to discussion. I get the impression, frankly, that he doesn't actually do much up there except sort of spin around in his chair in the Oval Office going, wee! But whoever's running the country, they have just made a total dog's dinner of it. And the left has realized that they don't have the white support that they briefly enjoyed, if that's the word, in 2008. And they have come to realize that if they wish to continue in their present level of power, they are going to have to galvanize basically every minority in the country against the white man. So yes, we are approaching a stage of outright racial conflict. I won't say race war because that would imply that there were two sides fighting, and that hasn't happened yet.
Well, I'll tell you what, for a long time, I was always one of these people. Number one, I would honestly much prefer not some kind of race war, just because, let's be honest, people die in war, and I don't think we're at any point where we can be affording to lose any of our own people. But for years, I said, that's just, for many people, it was like a utopian idea. For many people, it was a little bit of a frightening idea. But now, I always said that it was just not going to happen. That's what you want is to happen. But now I'm looking at this and I'm like, particularly with this Ferguson mob terrorism, I can actually really see this happening. Have you seen the videos, Harold, of Millennial Citizens United? Basically, it's a bunch of colored people who get together and they shut down shopping malls. And I think they were at the St. Louis Rams game and the Cardinals game. And
yeah, that was the St. Louis Rams game, I believe, was where they found or discovered white people with T-shirts saying, "I am Darren Wilson."
Yeah. What do you make of this? I mean, do you think that this plays into the idea of some kind of real overt racial conflict in this country?
Well, that is definitely coming one way or the other, and it doesn't matter what they say or don't say in Salon Magazine or what the Tea Party says or what anybody says. Racial conflict of a serious nature is definitely coming throughout the North American continent, here and in Canada, because, as the poet William Butler Yeats wrote, things fall apart, the center cannot hold. I don't believe that these people, these Democrats, these liberals, are competent to impose a 1984-style total tyranny on the United States, on Canada, or both.
Harold, if I can interrupt, do you think that that's because of the advent of the internet basically we are the media now, we're the real fourth estate. Do you think that's what's holding them back?
That's definitely a part of it. Basically, the internet has broken their media monopoly, and that's definitely a big part of it. Not to put too fine a point on it, they are trying to carry out this incredibly complex project of creating a surveillance state and a nationwide tyranny where everybody watches everybody all the time, and the liberals basically get to tell everybody what to think, et cetera, et cetera. They're trying to do this with racially inferior material. In essence, they're hoist on their own petard. They are the victim of their own policies. You see, the fact is black people and brown people of various kinds are not equal to white people, especially white males, in almost every area of endeavor. They have a system whereby people are hired and promoted on the basis of something other than merit or ability to do the job. Basically, people in liberal democratic system now are hired and promoted into positions of authority on the basis of the color of their skin or whether or not they got tits on them. And you can't do that and so expect your government and your society to function efficiently. They are going to lose because, you see, the fact is, Joe, we are right. White people really are superior. And the type of people that they are using, the type of people they're filling their government and their enforcement agencies and their military with, simply cannot cut it because of biological and genetic factors and because they're effing stupid compared to white people. So basically, they are trying to build this grand edifice of tyranny with very, very inferior bricks and mortar, and it's going to come crumbling down. There is going to be a Soviet-style breakup of the United States, and every individual minority group and special interest group is going to grab a piece of the pie. The Mexicans are going to get Aztlan in the Southwest. There may be some kind of Republic of New Africa or something in the South if the Mexicans don't move in and enslave the blacks, which I think may happen. There will probably be some kind of weird liberal stand on the eastern seaboard and up into New England where all the rich people have their summer houses. I'm sure they'll keep that nice and safe and orderly for themselves. Flyover country is going to be a mess. The big cities are going to just... Well, then, Detroit, I mean, we see what's going to happen in the big cities. So what's important is the white man has to grab a piece of the pie. We believe in the Northwest Front that that piece of pie needs to be in the Pacific Northwest, and we need to create a homeland
Before I want to set the table for that. But first, anybody who wants to start calling in, 857-232-0159, code is 345-925. I want to get to the solution, but let me present at least one more problem before we get to the solution in these last 7 minutes we have. This thing, and you talk about reading these, and look, I am personally under the assumption that most liberals are good people. You know what I mean? I think that they mean well. I think, you know, Rush might call many of these people low information voters. They just mean well. Live and let live. They're that kind of people. But it's these leftists, these communists that are the problem. And when you read these blogs, like you said, Slate and the other one that comes to mind is Salon. And
Salon is the one that really frosts my cookies.
Oh, yeah. Me too. And then you have The Atlantic. I don't know if you ever heard of that one. They have that one guy who I think his name is Coates. He's calling for reparations and he looks like he's here visiting from another planet. I mean, get real. So let me ask you this, and this may be an insult to you just to even have to talk about this, but I'm dying to know Harold Covington's position on white privilege. I mean, this is the kind of thing that I don't think is going to catch too much steam. It has caught mainstream attention, but I don't think it's going to go very far as an ideology because I've seen a couple weeks ago, I played a video of this Chinese kid who there's a blogging platform that's very popular among young people called Tumblr. And they're called social justice warriors. And there are literally, like that website 4chan, and like basically like these internet trolling websites that I'm sure have screwed with you a time or two in the past. They are fighting these like social justice warriors, these pushers of white privilege. What do you make of this white privilege garbage?
Well, I think that it is, number one, just basically an excuse for the non-white minorities to vent their hatred against our people.
In a sense, it's pushed by Jews and whites.
White privilege. We are white. See, this is one thing I figured out long ago, Joe, about blacks especially.
Yeah.
People say, well, they want what we got, and they want us to give them all their money and big Cadillacs or something. No, what black people really want is to be white, which they can never have. In a way, it is genuinely tragic. These poor, dumb animals are screaming and howling, and it would be really tragic if they weren't so violent and destructive, but they want something that they can never have. They want to be white, and that's just, it's not the hand that they drew in this life. I do believe, in the sense that the white man was not only very, very stupid, but morally wrong to bring them here. But that's it. It's what's done is done. They are here. And at some point in time, we are finally going to have to resolve this whole racial issue, because race is the American issue. But basically what they want is to be white. That's what they mean when they talk about white privilege. Our privilege is to be white. However, when white people who have borne the brunt of this horrible Obama depression, who have lost their homes, lost their jobs, who are now flipping burgers at McDonald's for $8 an hour and trying to raise a family on that, white people who've been victimized by the whole drug culture and the black crime and so forth, when they hear this term, white privilege, I'm getting this a lot in feedback all over the net and from my own people. When white people today hear the term white privilege, it makes them mad as hell, because they know of all people that white people are not privileged in this country, rather the reverse. And I think that whole white privilege thing may turn out to be one of the worst mistakes that the liberal left makes.
I agree. Now, let me ask you this,
so mad.
Harold. We have racist white cop shoots white officer. We have white privilege. We have all of these other memes that the media pushes and that left-wing kosher academia is pushing. To me, and I wrote about this in my book, it's not a race problem. It's a multicultural problem. Racism is contingent on a multicultural environment. They're, I guess you would, collectively exhaustive, I think is the right word.
Oh, yeah.
You know, these are the kinds of things that they cannot exist independent of themselves.
Well,
now,
racism is produced by contact with blacks. This is why we have a bit of a problem up here in the Northwest, because large parts of the homeland are, in fact, so white. We're dealing with people who have never had daily contact with blacks. What's solving that problem for us is they are having daily contact with illegal immigrants, browns. But anyway, go ahead.
The point I'm trying to make, and you're very right about that, maybe they'll try to import some of them. But the important thing here, and this is where I'm going to give you 2 minutes to run with, would not the solution be to have our own places, our own autonomy, a no-fault divorce? Hey, you can have what you want. Of course, you can have a multiracial safe zone. I have a couple of non-European comrades, good people, good upbringing. I have nothing, no problem with them. But at the end of the day, I don't want my children to look like them. I have no problem grabbing a beer. Hey, how was your day? But, you know, at the end of the day, the survival of our people is most important. Would not the solution to all of these problems be not just having our own places, but if you hate white people, if you're so wicked and racist, just give us our own homeland. Please tell us.
Well, that's in essence, to a certain degree, what we're saying in the Northwest Front. I'm starting to hear this more and more, not just from our people in our tiny little movement, but also from neoconservatives, conservatives of various types. Slowly but surely, the idea of secession and separation is really starting to percolate into certain elements of the Republican Party, the religious right, etc., etc. So that's another very encouraging sign. I think people who talk about this theoretically are making the mistake of assuming that the system will somehow work and that we will be allowed to do that. I can tell you right now, no peaceful or legal or electoral secession will ever be allowed in this country any more than it was allowed in 1861, because the dictatorship in Washington, D.C. and the power structure as it exists right now needs us. They understand that white people are the engine that keep this society running, and they can't allow somebody to come along and basically take the engine out of the car, so to speak. This is why things haven't been a lot worse for the whites in South Africa, because the ANC has enough sense to realize that South Africa, they inherited or seized, was a highly, still is to some degree, a highly technically developed society, and they have to have white people to run it. In essence, they're keeping 4 or 5 million white people over there as kind of slaves to grow the crops and keep the air conditioners running and keep their cars running and keep the elevators going up and down, that sort of stuff. And I think this power structure here in this country also has sense enough to realize that they cannot survive without white people. I mean, when you try, look at Detroit. That's what happens when you have a completely black city governed by and run by blacks. The fact is that peaceful secession would not be allowed, even if it was ever contemplated or seriously attempted, but it's not going to be peaceful, because the pressure on this continent and the violence and the economic deprivation and the chaos and the breakdown of government is just going to get to the point where it's going to fall apart. Like I say, I don't think these people in Washington, D.C., for all their evil intentions, are competent to maintain a 1984-style totalitarian society. What you have to realize, Joe, is that in this case, I am prophesying true. Even if the Northwest Front doesn't take off the ground, even if none of our little movement groups take off the ground, fact is that this collapse is coming. It is a matter of inevitability. And very soon, we are going to reach the point where theoretical discussions of nice, peaceful, legal divorces between our two respective segments of society, they're going to be irrelevant because facts on the ground are going to be irrelevant. You can't sit and debate parliamentary procedure in a burning building, and right. This is what North America is going to become.
And that's what
I am now convinced, and I wasn't for many, many years, but I am now convinced that we probably really are at some point in our future headed for a Mad Max type of situation.
Mm.
Things have just gone too far.
Well, Harold, we're going to have you back next week to talk about the election. You can check out Harold, northwestfront.org. Learn more about promoting this idea of racial secessionism, more or less to just end racism once and for all. I think that's the best way to go. Northwestfront.org, you want to talk to Harold, I'm sure he'll be glad to write you back if you're interested in moving up to the Northwest, and he'll help you up with the logistics of that. But it's The White Voice, number 76-857-232-0159, and the code is 345-925. Harold, thanks for your time today.
Okay.
Here's a little musical misogyny for you. This is The Country Gentleman.
Take me down to that river bottom, boys. Let me loaf around and take my time. Let me look at that place where I last saw her face. Let me sit down and think about my crime, boys. What I done to that pretty gal of mine. Well, that sheriff's coming, I don't care. His bloodhounds are sucking up the air. They're coming after a while to make me walk that last mile. But I ain't gonna cry, gonna smile. Cause it made me feel so good to see her die. Take me down to that river bottom, boys. Let me walk along that shady river lane. Let me stand once again where she took 100 men, where I first felt the squeeze of her chain, boys. Used to laugh at me when I was in pain. Oh, that holy angel and her dream, with that big ugly devil neath the skin. She was shy, she was bold, sweet warm, I've been told. Now her hot body flows in the cold, and her gold slips among the sugar cane. Last night I dreamed I was there, looking down at her face, pale and fair, with the red eyes and blue gills, swimming and weeping, all through her long streaming hair. Take me down that river bottom, boys. Let me loaf around and take my ease. Let me sit on that stump where she took that long jump, with my clothesline tied around her knees, boys. Cheating hands and clutching at the breeze, where she went straight down to her death, with that cussing and whiskey on her breath. And them lies from before couldn't help her anymore, and I laughed just to see her singing low. Just to know I'll put an end to that disease. Just to know I'll put an end to that disease.
Breaks. Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from an undisclosed location in North Dakota, waiting to get my truck work done. Yeah, this isn't the only podcast I listen to, and I'm assuming the rest of you listen to other ones, and you may recognize the reference. This one podcast that I'm referring to refers to an ant and a grasshopper. And the grasshopper is always after the ant because the ant's always getting prepared and stuff, and the grasshopper's bouncing around and playing and all summer long and stuff, and then winter hits and the grasshopper wants to go in with the ant, and he's left out in the cold and freezes and dies while the ant goes back into his colony. Well, I'm not trying to compare us with ants and grasshoppers. I think a more apt reference would be a bee colony. And Mr. Covington is trying to set up a new nation. May as well refer to it as a bee colony. And bees actually go and produce something worthwhile, honey. And they go and work to produce the honey. They end up pollinating different plants and stuff, and that's productive. So you go and piss the bee off, you get stung. So that's an apt reference also. Maybe we should go and make use of that. I don't know. It seems like an apt reference to me. So why aren't all you little worker bees coming home to the colony? Hey, that's a good one, huh? Because bees protect their colony and stuff. So I just thought that would be an apt way to refer to us and all that. So I guess you wayward little worker bees out there that are scattered around the country and even to the ones around the world, why not get your assets back to the colony where they should be and help go and improve the colony and stuff for the rest of the worker bees haven't made it back to the homeland yet. I have been up here well before even Mr. Covington was up here because my wife was from up in this neck of the woods. That's where she grew up at during her grade school and high school years, and she liked it. So when I was in the Navy, I got transferred back up here and liked it and stayed. The weather is a hell of a lot better than Michigan. The summers are a lot better than Michigan. And I don't have to listen to that damned jigaboo jungle bunny music with all the apes jumping up and down and raising holy hell. But if you guys don't feel like you can afford to make it to the homeland, I understand there's a lot of reasonably priced, darn right cheap real estate and homes in the Detroit area. Of course, I don't think you really want to live there because there's no assets there, there's no jobs there, and the police are, you know, wanting you to go and carry guns to protect yourself because they can't protect you. But if you were in the homeland, the bee colony, you'd have other bees there to protect you, to be able to swarm against the oppressive forces that may come against us and oppose us. So wouldn't that be a novel concept? So, all you little worker bees, it's time to head back to the colony. This is the Trucker, signing off from North Dakota.
Greetings, comrades. This is the Trucker coming at you from on the road in Utah on my way to Las Vegas. And for a different twist, I'm going to tell those of you who have not migrated to the homeland yet and don't plan on it why you should not come to the Northwest, to the homeland. For all of you on the East Coast, we don't have hurricanes here. Obviously, if you're still there on the East Coast, you must love your hurricanes and having to go on batting down the hatches every time one of them big ocean twisters decides to come in. For those of you in the Midwest, we do have a few tornadoes, but obviously you just love your tornadoes oh so much. So please, Dorothy, go ahead, stay there. For you down there in the South, obviously, you love your heat and humidity, especially that oppressive summer heat and humidity, which we don't get a whole lot of here in the Northwest. So, obviously, you like melting and sweating, so please, stay there. For those of you down there in the Southwest and stuff, enjoy your flash floods like the one they just had here last month there in Nevada that washed out the interstate. Yeah, we can have flash floods up here, but you obviously enjoy your heat, dry heat, and no humidity down there. So obviously we can't accommodate you up here in the Northwest. So please stay where you're at. And for those of you in California, you just love getting invaded by the beaners and stuff. So, I mean, yeah, we have a few of them up here, more than we'd like. So please stay there. Enjoy your salsa music and having the jungle bunnies every time some spook goes and gets attacked by the cops and the monkeys go and start beating their drums and their chests and burning down their neighborhoods and stuff. Enjoy. So please stay there. Enjoy your earthquakes down there. Yes, we get them up here occasionally, but sorry about that, comrades. I had to yell at the trucker dog here because he's whining. I think he spotted the animals over in the petting zoo at the truck stop we're at. And for those of you up in the northern tier and stuff, obviously you love your blizzards and stuff. Yeah, we get some snow here in the Northwest, but you just enjoy your massive snows you get up there, like in the Buffalo area and stuff, where you get multiple feet overnight and having the road shut down. Those of you across the plain states with blowing snow, yep, been there, done that. I know what that's like. Going truck through that all the time in the winter, because that's where our trucking company is at, up there on the off I-94. But obviously, where you're at is so much more enjoyable than the Northwest. So please, just go ahead and stay there. Yeah, anyway, just my sarcastic little bit of sense of humor today. All right, comrades, I haven't seen any moving vans passing me today on the way to the Northwest. All the way across Wyoming, didn't see any U-Hauls headed our way. I don't know. Anyway, all right, this is a trucker signing off. See you in the homeland soon, comrades.
They say can be done. We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound, just watch a bandit run.
I think the trucker would appreciate this one. It's kind of a migration song from Chris Whitley.
Kissing time, kissing, kissing.
Watch them lovers out on parade. Watch them lovers while they sleep and slide. They gonna prove it to the big sky country. They're just gonna prove it while the whole world collides. Yeah, like hallelujah in the big sky country. Just like forever and ever is fire.
Right, we're running long, and I'm going to have to give Gretchen a miss this week. Gretch, I'm sorry, and yeah, you're right, I probably did just phone this one in. But this week, I have an excuse in that I really do feel absolutely wretched. It's very difficult to sleep when you're racked by spontaneous spasms of coughing. I'm going to go watch the elections on the internet, and I'll comment on them next week if this Ebola doesn't kill me. Until then, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.
Well, they fought for poor old Ireland, Uncle Bitter was their fate. Oh, what glorious pride and sorrow filled the name of 98. Yet, thank God, it still is beating heart.